This is Minds Worth Meeting from Stern Strategy Group, a podcast where we talk with some of the top thought leaders in the world. Hey everyone, it's Justin and Whitney. We're working hard behind the scenes on producing season 3 of the show. We have some great guests lined up, but we couldn't wait to bring you this bonus episode.
Our friend and client Andrew McAfee's new book, The Geek Way, is out as of November 14th, and we wanted to catch up with him to talk about the book, his new HBR magazine article on how businesses can capitalize on generative AI, and more. Here's Justin with our conversation with Andy.
Welcome to Stern Strategy Group's Minds Worth Meeting. I'm Justin Lewis. Today we're talking with Andy McAfee, Principal Research Scientist at MIT's Center for Digital Business, co-founder of the Initiative on the Digital Economy, and you were also Google Technology and Society's inaugural visiting fellow. Tell me a little bit about that.
Google spun up a new organization a little while back called Technology and Society to look at exactly that intersection. That, you know, as we all know, there are a number of really important issues at the intersection of this period of crazy tech progress that we're living through and its societal implications. And Google wanted an organization inside the company to focus on that. And I was fortunate enough to be asked to be their first visiting fellow. In other words, an outside academic to come in and work with Google on subjects that are interesting to both of us.
And what are some of those subjects that are interesting to you?
These days, we're all so fascinated by generative AI that my initial work with Google is on the economic implications of generative AI.
Interesting.
Which, to preview it, are big.
Yes. And I do want to get to generative AI. But first, I want to get to the big thing that we're here to talk about today. Got a book coming out, The Geek Way, The Radical Mindset That Drives Extraordinary Results. I love the fact that we're turning geek into a good word, because I'm the kind of kid that, you know, I grew up on the playground. It was kind of, hey, geek. But I love that we are co-opting geek back again. So tell me about the book.
And I wish I could take all the credit for that, but it was my literary agent. It was Raphael Rafe Sagalin, who pointed to a couple paragraphs that Eric Brynjolfsson and I had written in one of our previous books about what we were calling this geeky style of leadership that we had observed. Mm-hmm. And Rafe said, that is an idea. You are identifying a new phenomenon. You are giving it a label, and that label has not been used adequately before. And he kind of looked at me and said, Andy, if you've got energy, there's a book here. And Rafe turned out to be right. And I love, like you say, reclaiming this label and taking it away from the kids that had their lunch money extracted from them by bullies in middle school, and instead redirecting it to refer to anybody who's what I would call an obsessive maverick, somebody who just gets obsessed with a tough problem, won't let it go, and is willing to embrace unconventional solutions. To me, that's my definition of geek these days.
I went to science camp as a kid, so I wear that proudly.
I went to math camp. I went to computer camp. Nice. We did these things. Good for us.
So how did geeks become the most influential people in modern management?
Well, there's an obvious story, and then there's a less obvious story. And the less obvious one is what I wanted to write the book about. The obvious thing is that the geeks, who are densely clustered in Silicon Valley, started turning out all of these world-changing technologies like the smartphone, like machine learning, like the web, like generative AI. And that is clearly transforming the business world. That's true. It's also a pretty well-understood story. I got obsessed by a different story, which is while they were churning out all these amazing technologies, the geeks were also doing another kind of innovating. They were innovating on the company itself. And the company's a technology. I'm not trying to be cute. The company is a thing that we humans invented to help us accomplish our goals. That's a technology. And one of the technologies that the geeks have iterated on and innovated on and spent the most time on over the past 20 years or so is the technology. And the reason I wrote the book is I became convinced that they had given the company an upgrade. They have learned how to build organizations that can kind of do it all, that can be simultaneously innovative, agile, that can execute at a high level, and that provide good environments for people to work in. This makes them really, really tough competitors. And I don't think we have seen the heart of the disruption. I think we're in the early innings of the disruption that's going to spread throughout the economy because the geek way is going to outcompete companies that don't follow it.
And so for those kinds of traditional companies that have always done the same thing the same way for generations even, how are they going to keep up with the geeks? What do they need to do?
One of the things I say in the conclusion of the book is that if you continue to follow the standard industrial era playbook, and we should be a little bit honest, that playbook was pretty good at yielding large, slow-moving bureaucratic organizations. That was kind of the default steady state if you followed the industrial era playbook. And I cite plenty of evidence in the book to support that conclusion. If that's the playbook that you stick to when the geeks come to town and they start iterating more quickly than you can. They start learning faster than you can. They engage in what I would call faster cultural evolution than you can. You're in trouble. You're maybe not immediately. Jeff Bezos has this amazing quote where he talks about stasis followed by irrelevance, followed by a long, slow decline, and then eventual death. So it's not immediate, but if you follow the old playbook when the geeks come to town, I think that's the trajectory that you're likely to wind up on.
What are those companies, again, the traditional ones, done the same thing? Where in the organization does it need to start? Does it need to start at the very top, or do you kind of need a voice lower down saying, hey, this is what we need to do?
Everywhere helps, but I think change of this magnitude really does need to be led by the top and come from the top. Because as we all know, organizations are pretty good at realizing if a change effort is just flavor of the month and if things are going to go back to business as usual, and they just wait the change out. Right. To get around that, I do believe that the top leadership of the company needs to be involved. And in particular, I try to make it as pragmatic as possible in the book, in particular, needs to start reorienting their company around four norms, four standards of behavior, four things that are expected by the people around you. Mm-hmm. And those are speed, iterate, get feedback as quickly as possible, ownership, push responsibility and authority down to uncomfortable levels, science, argue about evidence and go where the evidence takes you. And then finally, openness. Be willing to pivot. Be open to the fact that you might not have the right idea or that you might need to go in a different direction. Be open to both giving and receiving criticism up and down the org chart. To me, the geek way is based around these four norms of speed, ownership, science, and openness. And embracing the geek way is a matter of driving those norms into your organization.
So it might be a little bit of discomfort at first. The benefits in the end are going to be this new level of competition, of innovation. Is that fair to say?
Except for the little bit of discomfort. Okay. I learned enough and I've observed enough over my career to realize that this is a deep kind of organizational change. Any aspect of it is actually a big deal. Mm-hmm. For example, if you're an organization that has gone about planning and executing big efforts in this kind of classic upfront heavy industrial era style where you try to plan the heck out of everything and anticipate all the contingencies that'll come up, it doesn't work. And starting about 22 years ago in the winter of 2001, 17 very experienced computer programmers got together because they were so frustrated with the way that large pieces of software were being written. And they got together and they said, what can we do that would be different and better? And that was actually the birth of the agile development, the agile programming movement. The Agile Manifesto is still available online. And it's amazing how relevant a document it is because it said, we want to satisfy the customer via early and continuous delivery of valuable software. In other words, we're not going to plan and write down all the requirements, and then we're going to vanish for however long until we write software that meets all those requirements. And then and only then are we going to interface with the customer. The geeks said, no, we're going to do it constantly. We're going to have these fast cycles where we build things, get feedback on it, do it again. That approach, that agile approach, which is underneath the norm of speed in the book, that is applicable very, very, very widely. We see it used for everything from building the subway system in Madrid to both Tesla and SpaceX upsetting their industries by building products on this fast cadence, very iterative approach.
So we're not just talking about software companies or technology companies. This is relevant across industries.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things the business geeks have learned relatively recently, and I do think Elon Musk deserves some credit for this, is that the barrier between bits and atoms is not really a high wall anymore. And we see geeks founding companies in metal bashing industries and atom-based industries, not just purely digital fields. And they're applying that same iterative, agile approach to developing physical products as well as software. And lo and behold, that approach continues to work when we're talking about atoms instead of just bits.
Right, right.
And I do want to get back to the speed and the innovation in the software. So you have an article coming out. It's actually online right now in HBR about how to capitalize on generative AI. It blows my mind how quickly this time last year, we weren't really talking about this. So is it really as consequential as it feels? Is it a passing fad? Is it just going to keep going at this speed and then go from there? That's a lot of questions.
Yeah, we don't know exactly what's going to happen from here with generative AI, but I'm very confident that it's not just a passing fad. And like you point out, along with my co-authors and co-founders, Eric Brynjolfsson and Daniel Rock, we've got an article in the current November-December issue of Harvard Business Review advising companies on how to think about generative AI and what to do about it. And the message that we give them is that this is not a flash in the pan. This is not kind of a cute little technology that will let you write your annual report in the style of Dr. Seuss. Those are just dumb tricks. This is a very, very powerful, very general technology that can be used to do a huge variety of things in almost every industry. One way I think about it is that we finally have this other entity on the planet beyond us that understands language. That's kind of a big deal. You can do a lot if you understand language. So the advice that we give in the article is, first of all, take this very seriously because it's very broadly applicable. Mm-hmm. And the productivity benefits that we have seen from the early research are both large and they're quick to appear. So the first thing that we say in the article is, this is real. You need to pay attention to it. The second thing is to emphasize this geeky approach where there's a minimum viable plan. The startups founders love to talk about the minimum viable product. I like to talk about the minimum viable plan. What's the smallest amount of upfront planning that you need to do? Right. And for us, the answer is, where in the company do we want to start experimenting with Gen AI? Where will we get the biggest bang for the buck, the fastest bang for the buck? Once you've got that minimum viable plan, then shift into geek mode and start trying things and making sure that you're getting feedback and that you're getting an honest signal about what's working and what's not. But plan a little, iterate a lot is the right way to succeed with generative AI. Turning your back on the technology or delegating it and waiting for the task force to come back to you in 6 months, this is not the right approach.
Right. And in the article, you also talk about, while there are these great potentials, there are also some risks. What kind of concerns you most about generative AI right now?
For me, the biggest risk is that companies will be too slow with it. There are things that you need to watch out for. If you go about this the wrong way, you can leak sensitive information. There are concerns about intellectual property or copyrighted material that was used to train some of these models, and therefore, are you in legal jeopardy if you use the models that are trained in that way? There are real concerns. They are manageable. I can tell you the tech companies are working like crazy and devoting huge amounts of time and effort and money and energy to dealing with the known problems around generative AI. It's not perfect. No technology is perfect. The right way to proceed is to understand the risks up front, mitigate them. That's part of the planning process, but then get to work and start exploring.
So if I'm a business leader, been in the business for a long time, I don't really understand what generative AI is. Maybe I hear my kids talking about it. What do I need to really understand about it as opposed to just coming into the office and saying, we're doing generative AI, go?
Yeah, two things. First of all, where in your business are the opportunities the biggest? And our startup Work Helix can help answer that question. We help enterprises put a generative AI plan together. We talk about it a bit in the article. The right way to do it is to look at all the different jobs done in your organization and which of those jobs have which of their tasks most amenable, most suitable for generative AI. Turns out that's a question you can use technology to answer, or you can do a back of the envelope calculation and figure it out. But the right place to dive in is in one of your organization's sweet spot for this technology. I'm not sure you should deploy it first to your janitorial staff. They probably don't have as much use for generative AI as your marketing department, for example. Mm-hmm. But then again, once you've got the sweet spot identified and you've scoped out an initial project, the right way to manage that project is in a fast cadence, iterative way. Probably a faster cadence than most companies are used to.
Staying with the future of work, there are so many opinions out there, as there always are. And some people are saying that this is going to take away jobs. Some are saying this is going to make jobs even better. And then we have, this is going to create jobs. In your opinion, where are we within that kind of matrix there?
Every time one of these very powerful technologies comes out, this debate crops up again. Is this the technology that's finally going to lead to massive technological unemployment? I think by now the track record is very, very clear. We have had wave after wave of extremely powerful technologies come into the economy. One after the other, they have been net job creators. Now, obviously, some jobs go away in the presence of new technology. And I will be surprised, for example, if there are still a lot of stock photographers left in a few more years as image generating generative AI becomes so powerful. We can do photorealistic pictures pretty easily. So there are some parts of the workforce that are going to be at least partially automated. I think by far the bigger phenomenon, though, is that lots of knowledge workers are going to have their abilities augmented by generative AI. Think about a programmer. Most programmers are already using Gen AI pretty heavily to write a draft of some code that they need. To me, that doesn't mean that if the AI is writing the first draft for 80% of the code, that does not mean that 80% of the software developers are going to be out of work in a period of time. What that means instead is that as the cost of writing software goes down, the demand for that software might actually go up. The demand for software out there in the world might actually go up a lot as the price goes down. So I look forward to an explosion in creativity. I look forward to finally getting the productivity boost that we've been anticipating from the computer revolution. I think it's here in the era of generative AI. One last thing to keep in mind is that we are at very close to full employment, historically high levels of employment, workforce participation. Companies can't find the people they need to do their jobs. I don't think this is the moment when we should be worrying about massive technological unemployment when we have the opposite problem in not just the US, but a lot of places.
This perfectly leads into my next question. Whether someone's employed or not, what do people need to do right now to be able to succeed in the workplace of the future? What do they have to do right this minute?
The great advice here is somewhat geeky economic advice. It's become an expensive complement to something that's getting cheaper quickly. In other words, if hot dogs are getting cheap very quickly, being in the hot dog bun business is actually pretty good because demand for what you do is going to go up, even if you remain kind of expensive. So what's a complement to generative AI? A complement is somebody who knows how to use that, who knows how to manage this technology, can work as a prompt engineer or whatever we're going to need a year or two down the road, maybe can act as an interface between the human world and this weirdly new powerful world of generative AI that we've built. We need people at that interface, and we need people to get conversant and proficient with this very new, very odd technology. Those folk are going to be valuable.
Yeah. And I do want to say, I think it's important to note that I do not trust cheap hot dogs.
Noted. Right.
You've been researching human-machine interaction for years. This is not a new area for you. Do you feel like this is a time of unexpected acceleration? Or as somebody who's been studying this for years, have researchers like you expected this kind of ramp up?
I've learned to stop being surprised at being surprised. And that sounds a little bit silly, but there have been enough of these wow moments in my career that I kind of expect future wow moments. Now, I don't know what those are going to be. I didn't anticipate generative AI was going to become as good as it is, as quickly as it has become good. But I'm a little bit less surprised now that something like generative AI has happened because we have this very large number of people working very hard on problems around software and artificial intelligence and chip design and all the things that are going into the digital world and the digital transformation of the business world. There is a ton of effort being applied in all of these areas. We're going to get some surprises. We're going to get some discontinuities like generative AI. And I don't think we've seen the last of them. So for that reason, I'm an optimist about technological progress. And I should be clear, all powerful technologies come with risks and downsides. There's just not a technology that's an unambiguous good. I don't think that's how the universe works. We need to pay attention to those downsides, but I don't think we should let them dominate the conversation. I don't think we should let them dominate our perception of what's going on. Hmm. Powerful technologies are generally put to good uses by most people because most of us aren't bad actors or evil human beings. Right. The bad actors are going to get a hold of very powerful technologies and they're going to do harmful things with them. And that's a damn shame. And we need to learn how to deal with that. That's different than being pessimistic about the technologies themselves. So I'm a mindful technology optimist about Gen AI and lots of other things. They are bringing us into a more abundant world, a more prosperous world, a world where we can tread more lightly on the only planet that we have that's good to live on and that can improve the human condition and open up options for us. I don't think that's a Pollyanna view. I don't think that's a naive view of what technology does.
Yeah, and I think we've seen in the last 9 months, the fact that it is moving so fast and developing so fast that there are so many great potentials that we didn't necessarily anticipate.
And to me, this brings up the importance of adopting what I would call the geek way, this more fleet-footed, pivot-friendly, agile approach to getting things done in your organization and to just kind of piloting the organization over time. If you think that you can chart a course for the next 5 or 10 years that's going to remain the right course, wow, I wish you luck with that. I can't think of a part of the economy that is going to be that stable for that period of time.
As we get closer to the end here, I like to get a lightning round in.
Sure.
A couple questions I didn't prep you on.
Got it.
Want your gut answer.
Let's go.
What technology that did not exist when you were a kid can we not do without now?
Oh, I'd be lost without my smartphone. It's an obvious answer, but I'd be lost.
Okay. If we look back in 15 years, what do you think is going to have been the most important tech innovation of today?
If we look back from 15 years, by that point, we might actually have quantum computing. And then we'll be living in just a very different chapter of our relationship with computing technologies.
That's one that bends my brain a little bit. I understand how binary computers work. When it gets into the quantum and the implications on AI and things like that, it just, like I said, it bends my brain a little bit. Do you see this as being something that in 15 years, maybe something that we just see as every day?
Yes, I think that's a strong possibility. However, we still will not understand it. Quantum mechanics does not make any sense. People like Richard Feynman, I believe, essentially told us to stop trying to make sense out of it because it doesn't make sense. Okay. But however, we know the math that describes it with astonishing precision. So we can calculate, we just can't wrap our minds around the implications of the calculations and the implications of the phenomena. The crazy thing to me is that we are not only able to write down the equations that will tell us what's going on, we appear to be on the cusp of harnessing quantum mechanics to do things like compute in novel ways. Even though we profoundly don't understand them, we can still harness them.
Right.
I think that's just a wild chapter in the human relationship with technology. And I'll say it again, it's going to change the world of computing. It's probably going to change the world in both negative and positive ways. The negative ways are that the infrastructure that we've built up for privacy and security in the digital era, we're going to need to rethink that.
Right.
Root and branch. The optimistic thing, though, is that our ability to understand the world and simulate the world and combine it with artificial intelligence and these other innovations that we have, that's going to bring us into a very, very powerful, very exciting new era.
Yeah, it's amazing. So finally, what's your favorite app on your phone?
Maps, because I hate being lost.
Okay. I love that. That's usually the toughest question that we ask the smartest people in the world. It's hard to pick a favorite.
Yeah. I used to travel around. I didn't like the background feeling of nervousness about being lost. I don't like being lost. Mm. That worry, that kind of low-level anxiety has absolutely vanished from my life. And I think that's a big deal.
Yep. And I'm definitely old enough to remember printing out MapQuest directions,
right,
looking at the papers while you're driving. And I'm very glad that we don't have to do that anymore.
And we're not going back there, you know, barring anything really bad and unforeseen.
So if people want to follow you online, where can they find you?
I'm A. McAfee on Twitter, A-M-C-A, F like Frank, E-E. And online, my website is andrewmcafee.org.
Okay. So the new book, The Geek Way, The Radical Mindset That Drives Extraordinary Results. It is available right now, pre-order on Amazon. By the time this goes up, it's going to be right around the corner. It's going to be out. It's exciting. We've been looking forward to this book for a while, so I'm excited to get my hands on it.
And I'm excited to have it out in the world. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So Andy McAfee, really appreciate your time today, and congratulations, and good luck with the book.
Thank you. Those were excellent questions. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin and Andy. You can learn more about Andy McAfee on our website, sternstrategy.com. Here's Justin again to give us a peek into what's coming up in season 3.
All right, thanks, Whitney. Coming up in season 3, we've got some really exciting guests. We're going to be talking to NYU professor and author Dolly Chugg. We'll chat with Harvard professor, sociologist, and author Michelle Lamont. We'll also hear from UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism lecturer and author Nick Romeo. He'll talk about his new book that's coming out in January. And we'll have a conversation with Holocaust survivor and author Tova Friedman. That's all coming up in season 3 of Stern Strategy Group's Minds Worth Meeting.
Subscribe to Minds Worth Meeting now on your favorite podcast platform to be notified as soon as we launch the new season. And while you're there, we'd love for you to rate, review, and share the show with your friends and colleagues. Follow us on LinkedIn, X, Facebook, and Instagram for the latest in thought leadership for business.
Minds Worth Meeting is a production of Stern Strategy Group. Our hosts are Whitney Jennings and Justin Lewis. Alan Halimsky is our video editor. Whitney Jennings is Stern Speakers and Advisors Marketing Manager. And Brandon Pantano is our Digital Marketing Director. Join us next time for another episode of Stern Strategy Group's Minds Worth Meeting, streaming on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.